You would call me naive if I said that what a pregnant mother eats, drinks or smokes has no influence on her unborn child. But what about her physical activity and other lifestyle habits? And how about the father of this unborn child? Do his behaviours make a difference? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello and welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Meet Susan. Her life had changed dramatically, but not for the better. Watch.
My former lifestyle, back when I was in my 30s, I was very active. I used to walk anywhere from 3 to 5 miles per night, 6 nights a week. And I also did floor exercises for about 20 minutes to a half an hour, 3 days a week. You know, so I was pretty active, along with working and grocery shopping, cleaning the house. So I stayed pretty active. And then what happened was the internet came into my life. And I kind of got stuck on it for about 7 years. It didn't prevent me from going to my job. It didn't prevent me from doing my cleaning in the home or my grocery shopping or paying my bills. Like, none of that stuff was neglected. But what happened was all my spare time was up on the internet into chat rooms and doing a lot of reading. I started eating pizza, I started eating wings and all kinds of good food that's not so good for you in front of there. And then I slowly started packing on the weight. And then when I was 44 years old, I went through menopause at an early age. I stopped menstruating. And about a year after that, I was diagnosed with high blood pressure. I was diagnosed with high cholesterol. And that was 2 out of 3. It was controlled because I was on the medication with the high blood pressure. The cholesterol medication, it was like a on it and off it, on it and off it, because I knew in the long run it actually does damage to the heart. I went to the doctor, to an endocrinologist, because I do have a hypothyroid, and he did the 3-hour glucose test on me, and it showed that I was a pre-diabetic. I was not only pre-diabetic, but I was hypoglycemic. You know, plummeted after the second hour. I plummeted right down. And at that point in time, I knew that this was serious, that it could affect your eyesight, it could affect your heart, it could affect your kidneys, it could affect so many different things. And I knew that I had to do something, but I didn't know. I did not know the difference between a simple carbohydrate or a complex carbohydrate. I'm 52 years old, and I didn't know. And I just cried out to God. I said, Lord, please help me. Help me. I don't know where to start. I don't know where to begin.
On today's show, we have a world-renowned expert on diseases that affect us into the 3rd and 4th generation. Sean will take us through our paces, and Chef Mark Anthony will build a beautiful block of cheese for us to enjoy. Of course, there's more of Susan's story as well. So let's get on with the news. In the headlines, fathers slow, kids aging, more nuts, better sperm, and mother's diet, daughter's menopause. The loss of a father due to death, divorce, or jail is associated with cellular aging in children. Researchers examined data on family structure and measured the telomere length from 2,400 9-year-olds. The protective caps known as telomeres shrink with age and with extreme stress. Once telomeres are too short, cell growth stops. In this group, telomeres were 16% shorter when children had lost a father through death, 10% shorter if their dad was incarcerated, and 6% shorter if a father was absent because of separation or divorce. The effects were 40% greater for boys than girls. So let's support fatherless kids and dads. Stick around as much as you can. Eating nuts regularly could improve sperm health. 119 healthy young men were randomly assigned to 2 groups. One group ate 2 ounces or 1/3 of a cup of mixed almonds, hazelnuts, and walnuts a day for 3 months, The other group made no dietary changes. Sperm counts were compared before and after the intervention. That analysis showed significant improvement in those eating extra nuts. The study comes amid a decline in sperm counts across the Western world and where infertility is an increasing problem. So if you're planning a family, eat nuts every day. Exposure to malnutrition before birth appears to increase the risk of premature menopause in women. Natural menopause is a milestone of ovarian aging that results in the end of a woman's reproductive years. That typically happens around the age of 50. The development of the reproductive hormone pathway before birth plays a critical role in later reproductive health. So researchers in China looked at almost 2,900 Chinese women who were born during China's infamous famine that occurred between 1956 and 1964. The risk of premature ovarian failure, which is menopause before the age of 40, was twice as high in this group compared with unexposed women. There was also a tendency to undergo menopause between the ages of 40 and 45. Early menopause can carry an increased risk of heart disease, osteoporosis, depression, memory changes, and sexual dysfunction. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Today's guest is Dr. Kent Thornburg, Director of the Center for Developmental Health at Oregon Health and Science University. We met him in Indianapolis, where he was a keynote speaker at the American College of Lifestyle Medicine meeting. I asked him to comment on life expectancy and, from a health perspective, where we are headed in the 21st century.
You know, life expectancy is a really interesting thing that we can watch. In 1900, the average person was expected to live until they were 50. That seems short now.
It does.
And over the next 100 years, it went up almost linearly until 2010, when people were expected to live until they were 80. So we added 30 years of life expectancy over that 100 years of time. And it happened because almost all infectious diseases were eradicated. The only disease left in the top 10 now is pneumonia and influenza. It's the only infectious disease now that really counts against our life expectancy. So now we expect to live 80 years old. The sad note is that starting in 2015, 2016, life expectancy started to go down. Now, we weren't surprised because we've been looking at the increase in diabetes and obesity in this country for a long time, and we've been predicting that that's going to drive life expectancy down. Sure enough, in 2016, New York Times reported from CDC and other organizations that life expectancy for the first time in decades is now decreasing. The same thing happened last year. So now we don't know where this is going to stop. Life expectancy will decrease for a while at least.
And when you say your research, your area of research is, it's fascinating to me, but it's not just looking at what I'm doing in my lifetime. Explain a bit more about it.
Right. So we're very interested in your personal history, your biological history. And that means, what was your grandmother like? What was your mother like? And what are you like? And how did those two generations affect you? There's also a grandfather effect now we're learning. But the interesting part of this story is that the egg that made me was made in my mother's ovary when she was a fetus.
In her mother?
Yes.
In her mother's
yes.
womb?
Yes, she was a fetus in her mother's womb. And my grandmother was nourishing the egg that made me.
That's a mind-bending
it is.
Thought.
It is.
Three generations in one person.
Yeah, in one person. And what that means that the risks that I have for disease are in part determined by the nutrition that my egg got 100 years ago. It's almost exactly 100 for me now because my mom's in her late 90s. She's still alive. And it was about 100 years ago that the egg that made me was made in her ovary.
Wow, to think that your genetic imprint is a whole lot older than you are. More from Dr. Thornburg in the next segment. You don't want to miss it. Before the break, though, here's another way to look at our healthy choices.
Oh man, I hate raking leaves. It's such hard work.
Well, it's better for you than housework.
Well, what do you mean?
Yeah, yard work is better than going to the gym.
Oh really? How come?
Because the stale, sweaty air in the gym that other people have breathed in and out a few times, you get to breathe in.
Oh, yuck.
Yeah.
Well, I guess being outdoors, you get more sunshine on your skin, converts the cholesterol into vitamin D, which strengthens your immune system, helps your bones.
Yeah. There's something that you need to know, though.
And what is that?
Exercise does you more good if you have a good attitude about it.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Researchers have shown better attitude, longer life.
Yeah, and I also heard that women who have a positive attitude, they have less death, less diabetes, and less hypertension.
And less cancer. Because a good attitude combats depression and boosts your immune system.
So, would you mind if I do all this work? You just sit back, let me get the sunshine, the fresh air, and the hard work?
Well, it sounds a bit selfish, but I guess I'll just sit it out and watch you work while you get all the benefit. Come on, keep going. Doctor's orders. Many of us, when we transition to a plant-based diet, really struggle with the cheese thing, right? But I'll bet Chef Mark Anthony has got that problem nixed for us today.
Yes, I do. I've actually got a lot of cheese, vegan, healthy cheese recipes. And today I'm sharing with you one of my favorites.
I love getting people's favorite recipes. Here's what goes in it. 2 cups of water, 3 tablespoons of agar powder, 1 cup of raw cashews, 1 tablespoon of lemon juice, 1 tablespoon of nutritional yeast flakes, 1 tablespoon of powdered soy milk, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of onion powder, 1/4 teaspoon of garlic powder, 1/8 teaspoon of mustard powder, and 3 tablespoons of fresh dill weed. Mark, what have you got going on over there?
Got some water boiling over here, and we're just going to add 3 tablespoons of agar powder to this and get this baby broke down, is what we're doing. So we're going to let this cook a little bit here and get that baby broke down for us. If you want, this has just a couple more seconds here. It's already breaking down very well.
So what are you looking for as you're boiling that agar? Because that's a new product for many of us.
You're just breaking it down. It's just turning into a...
kind of jelly-like.
Yeah, just that's all you're doing.
Giving the firmness to the cheese.
Yep. And then what you got here is we're going to do some blending. Okay. So all the other ingredients go right into the... Vitamix here, the blender.
Yep.
So we've got lemon juice, we've got our nutritional yeast flakes, our powdered soy milk, salt, garlic and onion. I'm real big about garlic and onion.
Oh, yeah. And, you can't go wrong.
And mustard is one of those secret ingredients
this one.
Huh. I've actually done this recipe probably 7 or 8 times before I actually ever... got it where I wanted it.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot of times I'm doing recipes over and over and over, and then once I get it perfected, then we look at it. Right.
Then you put it in one of your lovely books.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. So we're just going to bring this in here and then give this a blend. And this is going to take a little bit.
Now the dill, do you keep that for last? Or
yeah.
Do you put that,
okay. Right at the end we're going to put that in. Now this is going to take a little work. And then at the last, I'll put the dill in.
Right.
You can tell how creamy it is already.
Yeah. Very smooth.
And of course, usually I'm scraping down the sides here a little bit. Oh, I can smell it already. So I still want those pieces of dill.
For the last blast.
Right, because I still want to have, you know, I don't want it blended too much on the dill part. So we're just going to just kind of.
Yeah, you don't want to turn it green,
pulse
right?
It. Right.
Right.
And that should do. All right. Now we're going to grab that container right there.
This one?
And, yep. And I'm going to trade you with this.
All right.
And then we're going to put this right in the container here. And, ooh, it's hot. And you can see some big pieces of dill in there.
Oh, yeah.
Most of it got blended up pretty good. But you don't have to worry about those too big pieces of dill. You can chop it up a little finer if you want.
Hey, who minds having some extra dill? I don't.
Yeah. And it really takes a spatula to get in here. Set
so
that aside for
thick.
Now.
Look at it.
Then you put that in the fridge, right?
Uh-huh.
Let me share this with you. And when it comes out of the fridge, boom.
That is slicing cheese.
Right, exactly. Look at this. This is one of those few things that, oh, you should taste it. It's just.
Don't worry, I will.
There you go.
Mind my fingers the right
way. Yeah,
there.
Yeah. But it's amazing. It's just like, you gotta be kidding me. Now, this is not a melting cheese, like a lot of cheeses melt.
Well, it melted in mammoth.
You'd have to use a carrageenan or something like that. But for sliced cold cheeses, mm-hmm. you could cube this into cubes if you wanted. Instead of slices, you would actually take a bigger piece and go like this, and you'd have your cubed. So if you wanted
to throw in a salad.
Right,
or
depending what your presentation is for.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Mm. It's all good.
It is. For that and other recipes, go to the website hopetv.org/gohealthy. Susan quietly slipped into internet addiction. Out went the exercise, the nutrition foods, and in came being sedentary. Menopause hit, and then hypertension, cholesterol, and finally pre-diabetes. She knew she had to do something, but what? You'll never guess what happened next. Watch.
The one night I was going through the channels and I came across, and today's show is going to be about sugar diabetes. And I thought that was my prayer answered. And it was Dr. McKibben, and I watched her show, and then I continued on watching it afterwards, and then I would write questions, and sometimes she would answer them on live TV when she was doing it live at the time. So she has been a tremendous help. A tremendous help. My cholesterol medication, I was still on that, off of it and on it. I no longer needed the blood pressure medication because as I was making those healthy eating habit choices, what was happening was my blood pressure started regulating itself. So I no longer needed the blood pressure medication. I was still having somewhat of a problem with my thyroid, or not the thyroid, the cholesterol medication. And I didn't want to take it. I would take it and then I wouldn't take it. I would take it and then I wouldn't take it. And eventually what happened was I stopped taking it altogether. And then my last count a year ago was like 249. And then, I got a little bit more active around the house because, what happened with my husband, he had a massive stroke. And I think with the more activity, is what actually brought it down. It's the best it's ever been. and I've lost the weight. It was a decision for, once I was told I was a pre-diabetic, it was a decision, no longer a diet, it was healthy eating habits. I threw the word diet right out the window. And it was eating healthy. And I actually ate more. And I was full. But I was eating more of the right foods. And then my sugar stabilized, my blood pressure stabilized. I no longer needed the blood pressure medication. I used to get a bursitis. That's no longer the case. So it's helped with any inflammation in my body as well. My scale was saying 215. The doctors was saying 225. I'd prefer to go at my scale. But it was through the healthy eating choices that I was making. I cut out all my sweets. I wouldn't deprive myself completely. Once in a blue moon, I might have like a sliver of something, but that was once in a big blue moon, like once maybe in 4 months. I didn't deprive myself. They say if you do, then you'll have a problem. Then you might overindulge. So if I had a sweet tooth, I would eat something but very little of it. You know, it was just the healthy eating choices, and it just automatically came off. It was like a pound to 2 pounds a week I was losing. So it took me a while, but it didn't seem like it took me like over a year, but it did. And I got down to 163. So I went from 215, from what my scale says, versus the doctor's 225 to 163. And that was all through healthy eating choices and eating the right foods. And in fact, now my hypothyroid, the medication had to be adjusted to a lower dose now too. I really believe that it's through, you know, like what Dr. Narita says, it's through exercise and healthy eating, you know, that makes you live longer and makes you feel better all around.
Live longer, look and feel better. She's onto something there. We're talking today with Dr. Kent Thornburg, director at the Center for Developmental Health. I asked him to explain the findings of his good friend and colleague, Dr. David Barker, who made some fascinating observations in the 1980s.
It turns out that he was studying maps of disease in the UK, and he discovered that heart disease rates were much higher in the north of England than they were in the south. And he started looking at that to try to figure out why would that happen. And then he found another map, and the other map showed deaths of newborn babies. And the maps looked exactly the same. And because the newborn baby death map fit right on top of the adult heart disease death map, he realized there was a connection. And he could have thought, well, they both died because there was some toxin in the air or something like that. But he was really smart. He thought, you know, the babies that were born during that period of time, some of them died, but the ones that didn't die went on to get heart disease later. That became his prediction, and he was absolutely right. The way he proved it is he found birth records in Hertfordshire, and when he went and looked at those birth records, he found that if you're born at 5 pounds or smaller, you have a 3 to 5 times higher risk of dying of heart disease than you're born in the 8 to 9 pound range. And there's this big linear decrease or increase in death from heart disease as you get smaller at your birth weight.
So what is developmentally different about a 5 pound baby versus a 9 pound baby?
Yeah, well, the differences are really profound. Babies that are born at the small end have many difficulties, and they've used all kinds of biological tricks to stay alive because they haven't been getting enough nutrition from their mother to grow properly. So they make fewer filtering units in their kidneys, they make fewer cells in their heart, their liver doesn't work as well because its liver's smaller and not biochemically able. One I should mention is the pancreas, which makes insulin, is also smaller. And the cells that make the insulin themselves are fewer. So those babies are born, when they're born, even their 6 pound baby or a 5 pound baby, the pediatrician says, oh, this baby's fine, take the baby home. And as far as we know, that baby's perfectly healthy, but they have new risks and they're more vulnerable having diseases later in their life. And we figured this all out since David Barker made that discovery.
Now we're talking about small babies, 5 pounders compared to 8 to 9 pound
yes.
babies. What about large babies?
Yes. Well, David Barker wasn't quite aware of this before he died in 2013. But the data were already coming out, which showed that this curve that I showed you that goes up for higher death rates and lower baby weight, it actually goes back up again for babies that are heavier. So babies born at the high end of the birth weight scale have the same risk as the babies born at the very low end of the birth weight scale. And that's primarily because babies born at the high end have a lot of fat because their mother had poor glucose control. She was essentially diabetic. And those diabetic babies that are called, the obstetricians called macrosomic, are the ones that are causing the statistical increase in the number of babies that are at that high end. And those babies that are born to diabetic mothers have risks for the rest of their life that put them at risk for diabetes and cardiovascular disease.
But these babies are different in terms of they don't have the problems with the heart, the liver, the pancreas, right? They're just too fat. Is that a quick summary?
It's not bad, but it's just slightly different than that. And what it is that you're right, that their organs, most of their organs have the right amount of cells. So it's a little bit different than the small baby. However, the epigenetic effect, that is the way their genes have been affected by this detrimental environment they have from having a diabetic mother, actually changes their genes, much like those same genes were changed in the small baby, that leads them to have higher risk.
So their gene switches have been turned on both the little babies and the big babies. Gene switches are now set for chronic disease as adults.
That's right.
What other in utero exposures might alter a baby's risk of subsequent chronic disease?
Well, there's an interesting part of this that we didn't know when David Barker made his discovery. And that is that as soon as an egg is fertilized in the oviduct, it starts moving through the oviduct for about a week of time. And during that week, it's reading the mother's nutritional signals all the way along.
And it's a single cell.
It starts as a single cell, yes. But it's while it's going, it's multiplying. And it's becoming an embryo.
If it's fertilized.
That's
yep.
right. And it's going to be ready then, if the uterus is ready, to implant and make a pregnancy. But you have to remember that during this time, the mother is not pregnant. She has an embryo, but she doesn't have a pregnancy. And during that time, her nutrition is affecting the way that embryo is going to grow once it implants. So just to give you an example, it's a bit of a bizarre one, but if an embryo could think, it would say, wow, this mother has poor nutrition. I better build a bigger placenta, or I'm not going to be able to get enough nutrients to grow as a baby. And sure enough, poor nutrition will stimulate the cells around the outside of the embryo that makes the placenta to multiply and make a bigger placenta. And that big placenta is an indicator, if it's too big, it's an indicator that the baby is likely to have cardiovascular disease later.
So you might then be able to look at birth at the size of the placenta to predict that child's health future.
That's right. And what we've discovered is if the placenta is either too small or too big compared to the baby's weight, both of those extremes, like the U-shaped curve I showed for birth weight, that baby with the placenta that's out of proportion will have a very high risk of cardiovascular disease and other chronic diseases.
Though most of us don't know what our placenta weighed, before the break, consider this. Have you ever heard of generational sins or generational curses? That concept comes from the Bible. For example, in Exodus 20, it says, "For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers unto the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments." It would be very unfair if we were punished for the sins of our fathers, grandfathers, and our ancestors, but science tells us that through our genes, we inherit some of our propensities for sin, and addictions are one of those genes. Then watch a child mimic their parents, and we're reminded of the influence of our parents and grandparents as role models to us. And now science is telling us that genes are turned on or off by those who are one, two, or three generations ahead of us. In the scriptures, Abraham twice lied about his wife being his sister. Those lies almost cost him his wife and his life. Abraham's son Isaac told the same lie about his wife Rebekah. Isaac's son Jacob lied to Isaac to steal the birthright from Esau, his brother. And Jacob's sons lied to him, pretending that their little brother Joseph had been killed by a wild animal when in fact they had sold him into slavery. Those generational sins had come down their line. Going back to Exodus 20, did you notice that God also promised blessings to 1,000 generations of those who live in loving obedience to Him? So why not foster a closer relationship to God today? The effectiveness of our heart and our lungs in pushing oxygen to every corner of our brains and our bodies depends on how strong and active we are. So what's going to push your oxygen today? Sean, what have you got?
We're going to push the oxygen today.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So we're going to call this like lungs to lunges, all right? We're going to be working it. You're going to feel your heart rate up, very cardiovascular intensive. I really want people to get into the habit of thinking about this space and turning whatever space you have into your own personal gym. All right, if you have a hallway, if you have an open space, you can do this workout. Get a piece of tape, do about, 10 feet of space, and that's all you need for today's workout.
And okay? It could be outdoors too, okay?
It could be outdoors too. That's even better. If you can get outside and get that oxygen, that's perfect. So we're going to take one of the exercises that we've done and turn it into a dynamic warm-up for today. Your skater. But your skater going left to right. Think about yourself jumping over a puddle of water. You don't want to get your new sneakers wet, so you got to get over the puddle. Okay?
Oh, wow. There's a good challenge.
There you go. Don't mess with those sneakers. Take a nice deep breath. The skaters are a great exercise because it works up your toes, it works your ankles, gets your blood pumping, and you got to slow it down a little bit to really have control of yourself.
And your bones.
There you go. There you go. 3, 2, and 1. Sometimes we don't have enough fun, right?
Right. I love those. Those are one of my fun.
Three exercises today. I want you to do them for 60 seconds each, okay? Remember I said about putting that marker on the floor here, there? Yep. You're gonna set your timer for 60 seconds and you're gonna do a walking lunge for 60 seconds. There you go. Keep it going all the way till you get to that marker, about face, and continue going back again. You do not stop until that timer goes off, all right? You're walking lunges. This is a great movement to just keep you going, get that heart pumping as much as possible, all right? My timer goes off in 3, 2, and 1. Exercise number 2, after your legs are on fire, taking no rest, I want you to squat down, point your toes forward, look forward, and side shuffle all the way from marker 1 to marker 2. Your goal is to not stand up. Come on, stay low. Yep. Keep on going for that entire minute. Keep the toes pointed forward. Challenge yourself. If you want to stand up, I challenge you not to. Come on, keep it going. Come on.
I want to stand up.
No, don't. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3. Come on.
I'm gonna go back.
2, and 1. Nice. Nice work.
That's nice.
Exercise number 3, right? We're going to take away the rest, the thought of resting, and we're going to skip all the way from one marker to the next. Again, keeping an eye on that 60-second mark. Get those knees up. Use those arms. Now, remember in our warm-up, we did the skater.
Yes.
Where we were pushing off of our ankle, our toes, warming up our ankles. This is the same thing. Now we're going forward.
Uh-huh.
This is your dynamic way of challenging your body to come out that comfort zone a little bit, okay?
Yep, we're there.
There you go. 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Okay, so 3 exercises, okay? You have your walking lunges, traveling from distance to distance. You had your side shuffles, traveling different direction. And then you have your skips, all right? Nice and easy, 30 seconds each. At the end, do me a favor. Try your best, right? Or tell anyone, try your best. 1 minute of rest only. When that timer goes off, you start it right back up again. Try to do that entire circuit about 4 to 5 times. You would have an amazing time. All right?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, so let's open up these hips.
Ooh.
Now that we've worked it all, the hips may get a little bit tight. Legs are here. We're gonna push forward, all right? Allowing our hips to open up a bit. Looking up. And breathe. Come back. I want you to point the toes up. Reach for the toe. And you'll feel a nice stretch in your hamstring.
Mm-hmm.
Bring that leg back. Bring the other leg forward. We're going to start like we did before. Go forward. Open up the hip. Take a nice nice deep breath. Point the toe up. Reach forward, stretching that hamstring, getting a good stretch from the muscles we typically don't stretch. Bring it back. Lunge position. We're good at it now because we did a minute of lunging. Shake out those legs, and we are done.
Woo! Thanks, Sean.
You're very welcome.
Nuts, like almonds and peanuts, are full of healthy antioxidants. But not every almond or peanut on the supermarket shelf has the same antioxidant punch. Most of the nuts' antioxidants are found in their outer soft covering. When this is damaged through peeling or blanching, half or more of the antioxidants are lost. Choose raw almonds over blanched and enjoy your peanuts with the brown papery covering intact. Choosing nuts in their natural state is another ageless advantage.
Time for me to answer your questions. Someone called in, what's the best way to boost my immune system? Well, your immune system is so very complex. Start with thinking about the three S's: smoking, stress, and sleep. So don't smoke, manage your stress, and get enough sleep. And then EFGH, exercise, food, gargling, and hand washing. Exercise with bouts of really vigorous exercise if you can, not just gentle walking, but do a little sprint or, you know, whatever will get your heart rate up. For food, whole foods, not processed foods, and lots of plants. Limit your sugar. Don't eat too much or too often. Those will all suppress your ability to fight infections. And then gargling. That sounds bizarre, right? But they found that gargling with green tea every day, it doesn't have to be green tea, it can just be warm water, but green tea was the best, significantly reduces those seasonal coughs, colds, and flus that really get our immune system down. Vitamin D is another really important thing. Don't be low in vitamin D or you're going to catch all those coughs, colds, and flus. So basically, if you look after your body, your immune system will look after you. Someone emailed and asked, what causes floaters in the eyes? Is it from dehydration? Well, floaters are those spots in your vision that look like gray specks or strings that dart away if you try and look at them, right? Actually, they are fibers in the jelly of the eyeball, and they cast tiny shadows on the retina, like the dust you see between a projector and a screen. And as we get older, we get more of them. Now, you should see a doctor if you suddenly get a whole lot more than usual, or if they come with flashes, or there's darkness around the sides of your vision. That's when floaters can indicate infection, inflammation, bleeding, or a torn retina. Now, someone posted and said, I am 250 pounds and 5'4". I am thinking of going on a fruit and veggie juice diet for a month. What do you think? I think that's too extreme. I think it would be better to do something that you can incorporate into your life long term. Now, I am not against juicing. I think it's a wonderful idea, but you might want to do it just for 3 days. You'll find that really hard. 3 days initially, and then every week, do it for 1 day of the week. Do that just for 3 months. See how it feels. If it works for you, just repeat that cycle. 3 days, and then every week, 1 day. And just be sure that you add some activity into it as well, because that will help to regulate your appetite and burn your calories. But by doing the juice fast, you can really reset your appetite center. Love these questions. Keep them coming by Facebook text, go to our website, and my team or I will do our best to answer your questions. Like us on Facebook and join our community. Now, let's see what's going down in the store today. Quinoa originated in the Andean region of South America, where it was domesticated 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. The Incas held the crop to be sacred, calling it the mother of all grains. However, during the Spanish conquest of South America, quinoa was scorned by the Spanish colonists as food for Indians, and cultivation was actually forbidden. Instead, the Incas were forced to grow wheat. It's not a true grain because it's not a member of the grass family, but it's a grain crop with edible seeds that come as white, red, or in this case, black, depending on the cultivar. It's become popular in the US, Europe, China, and Japan, where it's not usually grown, and that's caused crop prices to triple, making it now 10 to 20 times more expensive than wheat. There are a number of reasons for its continued popularity, One, it's easy to digest, it has a high protein content, and it's a complete protein. It contains lots of fiber, phosphorus, magnesium, iron, and calcium. In fact, it's so good that NASA's exploring quinoa as a potential crop for long-duration human-occupied space flights. My use of quinoa is much more down-to-earth. I boil 2 cups of water with 1 cup of grain for 15 minutes. And when it cools, I fluff it with a fork and serve it with a stir fry or in a salad. You can also germinate it and add the sprouts for added value. Bon appetit. In the last segment, Dr. Thornburg was telling us how the embryo builds a big placenta if the nutritional status of the mother is impaired. Yet most people living in developed countries have an abundance of good food. So I asked him to explain how malnutrition could occur.
Well, you should know that the American Heart Association did a study, and they came up with, from their survey, with the conclusion that about 72% of the American population is malnourished. They're undernourished because they eat poor diets, and many of them have what we call high-calorie malnutrition. They take in a lot of calories, they put on weight, but they don't take in nutrients, and therefore, from eating poor diets that are highly processed foods or what we call junk food, that leads them to take in calories but not get nutrients, and they become malnourished. And if 72% of the population is malnourished, that means that 72% of women who are pregnant are also malnourished. And the Heart Association also said that there's about another 25% that aren't so malnourished, but they don't have a perfect diet either. So they determined that only 0.5% of the American population eats a healthy diet. And therefore, the nutritional status of people is what we now call malnourishment. We used to think that was for poor African kids that don't get enough food, but malnourishment occurs in this country, and it occurs in most of the population.
And that means most of our babies are now being born with this risk situation.
Yes.
And will grow up so we can predict the next generation almost.
Yes, that's correct.
So,
I mean, most people don't think that our whole population is made up of babies that grew up.
Right.
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 So these babies that were malnourished will become the population, and the healthcare needs that they have will be because of the way they grew early in life.
And so we might look at someone with a problem of obesity and say, they have a problem. But in fact, that problem was generated some 1 or 2 generations ago. Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying. And it turns out that one thing that happens in a baby that's born either really small or large is that their brain gets rewired and their appetite changes. So they actually have an affinity for high energy foods. They like them. They're hungry more often than other kinds of kids that were born larger or in the middle. And therefore, their appetite drives them to eat more calories. And that is a very difficult issue to explain obesity. One of the problems we have now is people blame the obese person, but they don't realize if they had their brain, they'd look just like they do. So we have to realize that this is beyond the range of blame. This is an outcome of our dietary culture.
So can you look at a mother, at her BMI, her height, her weight, her obviously her diet, and predict just from her appearance what risks her baby will have? Is that what you're suggesting too?
Yes, although what we've learned is knowing a mother's stature and her body mass index is an indicator of nutritional status of the baby. But also, if we take into account the size of the placenta, most people don't think about placentas, but if you include that in it, it's highly predictive of heart disease, especially in men.
So I'm an OB. We used to weigh placentas,
yeah,
and we've stopped doing that. You're saying we should go back to
doing
that?
Yes, I am. And many hospitals are going back to it now, and including my own.
So it is a relevant piece of someone's health history.
Yes, it is. And by the way, I'm in cardiology, and we ask our patients their birth weight And we asked their placenta weight. Nobody knows what their placenta weight was, or hardly many people do. But they do know their birth weight, and they also know something about the health of their parents that helps us understand their history.
Is there a man story hiding in here? Is it only the mothers that have a problem, or?
There is a man story, but first I have to say, we have to be really careful that we don't blame women for the outcome of their babies. Because no woman intentionally cheats her baby of nutrition. This is the food culture we live in, and they live in it too. But men also live in that food culture. And men who eat poorly, who have poor diets, can pass on risk for disease in a smaller amount than the mother, but nevertheless measurable, through their sperm, through epigenetic changes in the sperm that actually affect the egg and the way the embryo grows.
Can you explain epigenetics, just in case our viewers don't? I know we cover it a lot, but just in case someone's
watching. No, we have to remind ourselves all the time of what epigenetics means.
Yes.
Genetics is based on what we know about your gene code. You get a code from your mother and father, and the combination of that code makes you who you are. It sets the blueprint for the way you're going to grow. But the truth is, the blueprint isn't necessarily enforced. Epigenetics is the modification of genes that can take place on the way they get turned off and on. And therefore, they're regulated difference. And misregulating a gene is just as bad as having a bad gene, so to speak. So you can have this epigenetic effect that comes from the diet of your mother, can change your genes, and you will pass that on to your offspring if it's not reversed.
And we'll find out how to reverse it in the last segment, so stick around. Remember Susan, an internet addict with metabolic syndrome, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and high blood sugar? Well, she started watching Go Healthy for Good and worked hard to regain her health. She dropped 50 pounds and was able to come off all her medications. Watch.
Last May, I fractured my shoulder. I fell down the steps, fractured my shoulder. And I didn't know why, but I knew God had a purpose for it. I didn't know what that purpose was. But I prayed and prayed that he would reveal it to me. And eventually he did. As soon as I got done well enough and released from therapy, that's when my husband had a stroke. So it was there to help him. And I think I had to go through that to make me a little bit more sensitive to his needs. You know, I had no use of my arm. I was like this in an immobilizer for 6 months. Six weeks. And to me, it would have been like, well, come on, just move the arm. And the situation is different. His is neurological, and I know mine was ortho. You know, come on, can't you just move it? Can't you just move it? But I understood it better because I had the problem. I think God had to soften me in that aspect so I could show the compassion, you know, to my husband. After my husband having the stroke, if I didn't have the energy, I don't think I'd be where I am today. You know, because that took a lot. I mean, like helping him, you know, help bathing him, helping him get from point A to point B. There was a lot that was involved there. And driving him to his therapy and plus all the running around I had to do when he was in the hospital, when he was in the ICU. You know, there was a lot involved and a lot of, you know, people I had to speak with on the phone, places I had to go in person besides making sure I'm there for his therapy and watching them very closely and so I can make sure that I'm implementing it at home and then, you know, taking care of everything at the house. I don't think like years ago, like when I was heavier, like in 2012, and I had the problems with the bursitis and the high blood pressure and the diabetes and all that, I don't think that I would have had the energy, and plus I was overweight too. I would not have had the energy that I had, I don't think, to be able to do everything that I've done. And I always believe that God's plan is the best plan.
Yes, it is. And so is his health plan. We're learning how the lifestyle of our parents and grandparents sets us up for obesity, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. Though at the end of the last segment, Dr. Thornburg mentioned it could be reversed. I asked him to expand on that.
Well, you can't change your genetic code you get from your parents. It's set and it's in every cell in your body. However, you can change the way those genes get turned off and on, the epigenetic regulation of genes, And it turns out that eating a good diet, a nutritious diet, living a healthy lifestyle, can slowly modify the genes that otherwise would have been misbehaving and leading you to having disease risk later. So there's good news in this. We don't know the extent to which they can all be reversed, but we know that reversal is possible.
If someone knows that they're an outlier, they either weigh less than 5.5 pounds at birth or over 10 pounds, what would your advice be to them to reduce their risk of disease?
Yeah, so babies born at the small end of the scale or the large end have these risks because they've been epigenetically programmed, we call it, to have risk for disease. That can be changed. And we now know that beginning very early in life, right after birth, good breastfeeding, good diet that babies are weaned onto, and a good diet through childhood can already start reversing the risk that was added by these epigenetic changes. Someday, we're not ready now, we will be able to take a blood sample, look at people's DNA and the epigenetic changes that have been made in those, and tell them actually what their risk is. Birth weight is a crude marker, but your epigenetic profile is going to be the marker that will make a difference. And I expect we're going to see these markers change dramatically as people improve their lifestyle.
And another piece would be physical activity, wouldn't it?
Oh, physical activity is extremely important. It needs to begin in the mother so that she exercises during pregnancy. And also it needs to be ways in which children are able to move about and enjoy play. This is extremely important, not only psychologically, but the physical activity makes a difference in their genes already. There have been studies in adults that show that quite a number of genes are modified positively by exercise, even in later life.
And that work suggests it happens right on the spot, doesn't it? That within 20 minutes of starting to work out, there are epigenetic changes.
Yes. One of the problems with those studies is that they show that the gene expression patterns can be changed, but we don't know if they last. So we get hyped over seeing that there's this instant thing, and I'm happy about that, but we still need to do more studies to make sure that 2 weeks later and 2 months later, those changes persist from a benefit. I think they will.
Well, as a lifestyle medicine doc, I hope those changes are happening every day down at the gym.
Absolutely.
If you know what I mean. So that even if they didn't last for more than 24 hours,
yeah,
or 3 days, say, that actually by,
yes,
repetition, mm-hmm, and habit, mm-hmm, we're actually changing things.
I don't disagree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got a grandchild.
I do.
And what epigenetic changes are you insisting on your
own? Well, I'm working on him, let
really?
Me tell you. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a great kid, and he eats well. And he luckily does not have a high-level appetite like some of his classmates that really have a hunger for eating really poor nutrition and eating foods that are unhealthy.
It's a hard cycle to break. So what's your suggestion for three generations of eating highly processed food, appetites being driven? How do we break that cycle?
Right. So this is a huge task. I spend a lot of my effort thinking about the answer to your question. And that is that we need a population that's well-educated about where good health comes from. We're not. For the last three generations, we've listened to food industry to help us decide what to eat. That's been the hugest mistake of the American health system. And now we need to inform patients and kids in school and kids at the university about the real truth of why people are getting sick when they get older. And we've seen, beginning in the mid-90s, the numbers of people with diabetes just going up like this. And we believe that tipping point there is because those people that are now getting diabetes are the third generation of eating processed foods, and they've accumulated epigenetic risk over these three generations. So in order to change this, there has to be a big change in the way we see food and the way our physicians talk to us about how to get healthy.
But the food industry has been leading us down the garden path, there needs to perhaps be more regulation, don't you think, of how much freedom they have to tell the mistruths that they tell us about their food.
I agree. We need to change policies regard to food, the food industry. We need to make it more expensive to eat foods that are dangerous. And we need to talk about people's buying habits, because food industry only wants one thing. They want to make money off of selling their food. And already the soft drink industry has noticed that people are drinking fewer soft drinks, and they're diversifying into selling water and other things to keep their profits up. And I think this pressure is really important. People need to eat less often in fast food places, and they need to buy food that is healthy, and the food industry will have to change their habits.
So we have the power because we hold the wallet.
Yeah, that's right.
Our life expectancy is going down because of the epidemic of obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, though our generation has been set up for this epidemic by the health behaviors of those two or three generations before us. But there's hope. Like Susan, we can work to reverse the trend for ourselves and for the generations who come after us. Physical activity, nutritious food, proper sleep, and other healthy lifestyle behaviors can make a big individual difference. And as Dr. Thornburg says, our purchasing power can influence the food industry to change for those around us. So don't give up. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.